In 2008, as the global market crisis took hold in the US and other countries, a World Economic Forum survey ranked Canada as having the soundest banking system in the world. One of the reasons the governor of the Bank of Canada, Mark Carney, has since been invited to serve as the first foreign head of the Bank of England. Is this assessment of Canada's banking system sound? In this half hour, David McDonald of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives explains his belief that, contrary to what is widely believed, Canada's banks were bailed out by the Canadian government to the tune of over $100 billion. And has the Bank of Canada and the Canadian government surrendered its most important functions to foreign interests? Lawyer Rocco Galati will join us later to explain the lawsuit he is championing against the government and against Canada's central bank that makes that very case. On today's show, Canada starving the people in order to feed the banks. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 6, 2012. I'm program host and creator Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. We'll begin our show with some of the major news stories shaping the national and international political landscape. The Obama administration is prepared to take America over the fiscal cliff if it cannot wring vital concessions from the congressional Republicans on tax hikes for the wealthy and a raising of the debt ceiling. Dan Pfeiffer, White House communications director, said, quote, "This is a choice of the Republican Party. If they are willing to do higher rates on the wealthy, there's a lot we can talk about. And if they are not, then they'll push us over the cliff," unquote. The move could upset precarious financial markets as the economy is recovering. Obama wants a deal, but as his Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner explained to CNBC, quote, "There's no prospect in an agreement that doesn't involve those rates going up on the top 2% of the wealthiest of Americans," unquote. Barack Obama campaigned on a pledge to return tax rates on the wealthiest Canadians to their levels in the 1990s. According to exit polls, 60% of Americans support that position, and according to a recent poll, 53% of Americans would blame Republicans if America goes over the fiscal cliff, compared to 27% who would blame Obama. The cliff is the mandated reductions in the federal deficit, mandated by the sunsetting of the Bush-era tax cuts and last year's Budget Control Act, which ended last year's debt ceiling crisis. And that's brought to you by the Associated Press and CNBC. Palestinians are calling for immediate action from the UN Security Council to stem the erection of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. In a letter to the Security Council, Palestinian charge d'affaires Feda Adel Hadi Nasser decried what he called, quote, "Israel's contemptuous response to the UN vote on last week's vote recognizing Palestine as a UN observer state." One day after the vote, methodically, Israel announced 3,000 new settlements in occupied Palestine and two other projects separating the West Bank and Palestine's declared capital of East Jerusalem. As it states in the letter, quote, "Israel is methodically and aggressively pushing ahead with this unlawful land grab and colonization of Palestine with the intent to alter the demographic, graphic composition, character, and status of the Palestinian territory, especially in and around East Jerusalem and the Jordan Valley, in its favor, in order to entrench its illegitimate control of the land and prejudge the outcome of final status negotiations," unquote. The U.S. called the Israeli settlement plan unhelpful, but gave no indication it would support a U.N. resolution against the building of the new settlements. That comes to us from the Associated Press and the Canadian Press. Clashes between defenders and detractors of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi erupted outside his presidential palace Thursday during the worst crisis he has faced during his 6 months in power. Fires burned in the streets as rocks and petrol bombs were hurled on both sides, and riot police struggled to divide both sides. According to the Egyptian Ministry of Health, 5 have died and 350 injured in the violence. The protests have spread to other cities, including Suez and Ismailia, where the Muslim Brotherhood's political party offices were torched. Morsi's opponents are reacting to a draft constitution pushed through by the Islamist-dominated assembly, which does not reflect the aspirations of the entire nation. As well, they are concerned about Morsi's November 22nd decree, according him extraordinary powers in a newly created autocracy. His vice president, Mahmoud Mekki, announced his government would amend the constitution in consultation with the opposition, a written agreement forged and then submitted to parliament to be ratified in a constitutional referendum December 15th. And that comes to us from Reuters. According to recently released files from the Stasi secret police in Berlin, East Germany sold thousands of its citizens to Western pharmaceutical companies to be used as human guinea pigs in drug trials. The former German Democratic Republic made millions in cash from the top secret project. Tens of thousands of sick people were treated with untested medicines and dozens killed from the side effects. The conspiracy involved the state, German doctors, and Western pharmaceutical firms. The project, exposed by journalists Stefan Hoge and Karsten Opitz, was screened in Germany in a documentary called Test and Dead. Pharmaceutical historian Christoph Friedrich from the University of Marburg explained the motivation of the East German government was linked to critical shortages of drugs in the country, including hospitals. He said, quote, "A secret conference with Politburo Central Committee members responsible for health care provided the stage for a momentous deal in the spring of 1983. Paperwork in the Stasi files shows that Western drug corporations signed contracts with a GDR foreign trade company. From 20 tests in 1983, there were 165 underway in 1988, unquote. The researchers could find no documentation in the Stasi files or the records of the former East German Ministry of Health showing the patients knew they were in fact being used as test models, and that comes to us from the UK Daily Mail. A makeshift bomb exploded at the offices of Golden Dawn, Greece's far-right political party, Tuesday. The blast from the dynamite-packed device placed outside the office in Athens suburb of Aspropyrgos blew out a wall and smashed windows at a nearby building but injured no one. The ultra-nationalist party, which calls for the expulsion of all foreigners and of what it calls the stench of immigrants, has seen a rise in popularity during the Greek debt crisis. In the June elections, it received the support of 7% of the voting public and has prompted activists and politicians to have it banned. According to the independent polling firm VPRC, Golden Dawn enjoyed the support of 14% of the voting public, making it the third largest party in the assembly. This was a poll appearing last October. Greece is now in the fifth year of a recession that has left one in four jobless and eroded living standards, and that comes to us from Reuters. According to a German academic, former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger conferred with former Nazis about overthrowing the left-leaning Social Democratic government of Willy Brandt in 1970. This was at a time when Washington had become aggrieved of the German Chancellor's engagement policy with communist East Germany. A spy agency known as the Little Service, made up of old Nazis and elite aristocrats, was assembled by the Christian Democratic Union following its defeat in the 1969 election. The all-white, all-male conservatives of the CDU wanted to isolate the Soviet-backed regime, not engage it. Among the individuals involved with the little service were the former head of the German Domestic Intelligence Agency, the BND, the cousin of the man who failed to kill Hitler in the 1944 bomb plot, and Alfred Seidel, a former Nazi who acted as the chief defense lawyer for Hitler deputy Rudolf Hess. Political scientist Stephanie Waske had spent 7 years poring over letters from politicians of the CDU and its Bavarian counterpart, the Christian Social Union, and is to publish her research next year. Details have already been published in the German intellectual weekly Die Zeit, and that comes to us from the UK Daily Mail.
The Canadian government has gotten a lot of credit over the last few years for having survived the recession of 2008-2009 better than any other country. So the Canada has, for example, gotten a lot of has announced that they did not bail out their banks the way the United States did. There was concerns about that have been raised about Canada purchasing insured mortgage pools through the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, but in response, in 2008, just before the federal election, Minister Flaherty had stated, quote, "This is not a bailout. This is a market transaction that will cost the government nothing." Well, a report was released just last April by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, which essentially states that Canada did, in fact, bail out its banks to a much greater extent than most people had realized. To tell us more about that report, I'm joined on the line by the author of that report. He is David MacDonald. He is a senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and he also heads the Centre's Alternative Federal Budget. So thank you very much for joining us, David MacDonald.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so the government did not bail out the banks. That's the common wisdom. Is it your opinion that that's maybe a false assessment?
Yeah, I mean, this is a real minute point of language as to whether it's a bailout or whether it's liquidity support, which is what the government called it. The fact is that in Canada and in the U.S., big programs were created by the central banks and by agencies to buy up mortgages. So the U.S. Federal Reserve, for instance, created a big program to support its banks. In the U.S., the financial press called that type of program a quote-unquote bailout program. In Canada, we called it a backstop program. So we can argue about whether it was a bailout or a backstop, I suppose. But the programs were functionally identical in Canada and the U.S. Both of them provided significant amounts of short-term loans to the big banks. And in fact, the Canadian banks were accessing both these short-term loans from the Bank of Canada as well as the U.S. Fed at the same time as they were pulling out money from CMHC through the sale of their mortgages.
So with that kind of transaction, I mean, as I understand it, this was supposed to be about making it easier for banks to lend, right? About providing long-term credit?
Well, part of the problem is that banks are increasingly reliant on shorter-term credit markets, like repurchase markets, which are short-term loan markets, and in some cases make up about a third of all the bank's borrowings. And so what happened during this financial crisis was that the short-term markets completely evaporated. And so now all of a sudden these banks that were relying for a third of their capital in these short-term markets couldn't access that money anymore. So it was a real problem for the big banks in Canada and the U.S. And so they turned to government and said, look, we're using this short-term capital. Saved us some money. Turns out that wasn't a great idea because when times turn bad, all of a sudden we're short of cash. So can you become the market and fill in that cash for us? And in both cases, the Canadian U.S. governments obliged them with the Bank of Canada creating a facility that mirrored the U.S. Federal Reserve's facility for short-term loans.
So in over the course of researching this, how much assistance did you have in getting that the raw data available. It sounds like it was not an easy feat.
Yeah, it's no surprise that these programs happened. I mean, it's not that the programs themselves were secret. They weren't secret. Despite the fact that this is really the first time where I've done where anyone actually has done an analysis post bailout and figured out how much money actually went out the door, it was about $114 billion to support the big five banks in Canada. And that came not just from Canada, but it also came from the U.S. One of the things that I was very interested in was in the U.S., the U.S. Federal Reserve has released its information about who took what loans, when, how much they took, and what they put up for collateral. But what was really interesting was that the Bank of Canada and CMHC has yet to provide that information to taxpayers. So taxpayers did go and provide $114 billion worth of support to Canada's big banks, but they don't yet have the right to know who they gave that money to, who took the money, and what they put up for collateral. And so that was one of the big parts of this report, was to try to actually estimate who was taking this money.
Now, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an economist myself, but I mean, if this money is going to the banks, over $100 billion, is there any sense in which, because as I understand it, we've borrowed money from those banks. So is there any sense in which you're replacing some of that money? I don't think so.
Yeah, there may have been. I mean, certainly what was happening on the CMHC side, where the government was buying CMHC mortgages, essentially what was happening was they were buying CMHC mortgages and the banks were turning around and buying government bonds that were created in the first place to fund the mortgages. So it's a bit of a circle there. I mean, I think what was interesting is that no one is disputing these figures. No one's disputing the fact that the banks took over $100 billion in support. No one's, in fact, disputing my findings that some of the banks received over 100% of their stock value in loans and mortgage purchases. And so, what they want to debate is whether it's a bailout or a backstop. And to me, that's sort of beside the point. I think what's important is that Canadians get a chance to figure out where did their money go. And could we do this better next time around? You know, could we design the system with better regulations so that next time around we didn't have to put up $114 billion? Maybe next time around we'd only put up $20 or $30 billion, which I think would be much more acceptable.
So we're talking about the period from October of 2008 to July of 2010. What happened to Canadian mortgages themselves over that period, and how does that impact over the overall picture?
Yeah, so a big part of this picture was actually CMHC buying mortgages back from the banks. So they bought about almost $70 billion worth of mortgages back from the banks. And TD Bank in particular is one of the biggest banks in Canada for doing this type of securitization, which means they take mortgages and they sell them to someone else. This is actually a big problem in the U.S., and is often cited as one of the big issues in U.S. mortgage underwriting, is that firms were giving out mortgages, but since they didn't have to hold them, it didn't matter to them whether they went bankrupt or not. So they just passed them along up the line. And in Canada, what's actually happening is that this purchase by CMHC of these mortgages actually encouraged more securitization, because the banks realized that if they wanted to get all extra cash out of CMHC, the only way that they could do that was securitizing more of their mortgages and selling them to CMHC. And so what's interesting here is that this actually encouraged this trend of mortgage securitization in Canada that wasn't nearly at the same level as it was in the U.S.
And as I understand it from your report, there were three of the big banks that were completely underwater at one point.
Yeah, that's right. So at some point during this period, Scotiabank, BMO, and CIBC were at some point received support worth more than the value of all their shares. So to put it another way, it would have actually been cheaper to have purchased every single one of their shares than it would have been to provide them with the loans and mortgage purchases that they received. And so, I'm not arguing that we should have bought the shares necessarily, but it just gives you an idea of what the scale of the support was for the big banks. There's unemployed Canadians that can't get their EI checks because, you know, we can't find an extra $50,000 or $100,000 to hire an extra person to take in, more EI calls. But when the banks need some money, then the doors fly open and we can get $100 billion out the door, you know, really in a matter of months. I mean, the peak borrowing for the banks actually happened in early 2009. So it was only a matter of months that we managed to put $100 billion out the door. And so, you know, we can move these kinds of resources for the banks, but we can't move them for unemployed people. And so, you know, or other people that, you know, that need a hand. And so I think it really shows a differentiation of what's important in the government's mind.
Well, you're raising an interesting point, because we keep hearing about austerity, tighten our belts and so on and so forth. And, you know, they're talking about having to, you know, be cut back even further on all sorts of projects because we've got to get our finances in order. And it sounds like we're, you know, sky's the limit where it comes to these banks.
Yeah, and so I think that's really a contrast that's interesting, is that all, you know, all hands are on deck for the banks, you know, whether it's mortgages, whether it's short-term loans, several different agencies were involved. These banks were taking from the U.S. Federal Reserve in addition to the Bank of Canada. And there are massive amounts of money that went out the door in a very short period of time. And so these resources can clearly be marshaled for something like the banks. But when it comes to actually sort of you know, spawning economic growth in Canada, encouraging economic growth, helping people who've been laid off, all of a sudden it's austerity for them. But for the banks, the sky's the limit. And so I think this real difference between what the banks received and what regular Canadians who are unemployed or looking for a job received, you know, I think really shows a stark contrast.
Now, I haven't heard this issue debated much in the House of Commons. Have you?
Well, you know, I think what this report I think really pointed out is that, and what was interesting to me, because it received a fair amount of media attention, is the really the high regard with which we hold our banks here in Canada. They are in essence a cultural institution, like healthcare, for instance, or the CBC. And so any sort of analysis that says, you know, the banks may have been in more trouble than they let on or that the government let on, often falls on deaf ears from the government's perspective. You know, banks, just like healthcare, is something you rarely talk about in politics. And I think that does us a disservice. There was a lot of money that went out the door. The banks thought when they were receiving this money that no one would ever figure out who took how much money and what they put up for collateral. Now, I managed to do that in this report. And I think it gives us a window into how risky the banks thought they were themselves. How much money did they think they needed to get through this crisis? And so I think if we fail to analyze where this money went and how we could do this better next time around, we're unfortunately destined to probably continue this type of approach. So whenever there's, you know, if and when we do see another liquidity crunch like this, we'll likely see, you know, $100 billion, if not more, go out the door a second time around because we weren't willing to take a look at the issues, take a hard look at why some banks were taking so much more than others, and try to fix this from a regulatory perspective after the crisis has passed.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you see any indications that all the money that's flowed to the banks in this way is doing more than simply keeping them afloat? Are they utilizing it for other initiatives they couldn't get away with otherwise?
Well, you know, on the mortgage side, for instance, they took out, they sold many, you know, multiples more mortgages back to CMHC than they would have provided in an average month or an average quarter. So this wasn't about sort of providing a bit more money so they could continue to provide loans. You know, the amount of loans that they were providing was relatively small, dwarfed, in fact, by the amount of support that they got from CMHC. And on the loan side, you know, for small business loans, for instance, to encourage economic growth, there isn't great evidence that this money was recycled into small business loans. It appears that most of it was just recycled into buying government bonds, which is sort of neither here nor there. So, you know, there isn't great evidence that this necessarily supported more mortgages or more small business loans. And in fact, you know, it's a question of whether banks should be pushing more mortgages on Canadians in the first place, I think is a real active question given the debt to disposable income ratio that's at record highs. And as well, you know, you can argue whether this is supply driven or demand side driven. So whether whether banks, you know, sort of offering loans to businesses is the same as businesses actually wanting those loans. And the fact is, in Canada, businesses are flush with cash. I mean, you know, they're sitting on over $500 billion worth of cash in Canada. So they're, in fact, not in desperate need of money. They actually have a fair amount of money. They just don't know what to do with it. You know, this money definitely did go in to support the banks. It allowed the banks to get out of, to trade longer-term mortgages in for cash that they could use other places. Certainly the banks have been active in purchasing smaller American chains so they can get a better foothold in the American market. And so it's difficult to put the aggregate picture together here, but it's not a clear-cut sort of, you know, connection where CMHC bought some mortgages so they made so the banks therefore wrote more mortgages. That kind of connection is not nearly as clear as you might think.
If I could just put one more question to you. Given the extent to which the Canadian government in actuality did provide support for the banks, can some sort of a case be made here for nationalization of our banks?
I'm not sure necessarily that the government should be in the business of retail banking. I mean, the government isn't the business of banking in some sense. The Business Development Bank or the Export Development Corporation are both examples of government using banking as a means to encourage commerce in particular areas. I think what it does show is that the banks, particularly when times are bad, and particularly with the way they're being structured today, require a lot of government support, and in essence are being subsidized by the government. And so I'd argue that this isn't necessarily a case for nationalization, as it is as a case for higher tax rates for the banks, that they pay back this inherent subsidy that they're getting, such that when things go bad, the government has to drop everything and rush with $100 billion to the banks, hoping that bad things aren't going to happen. This is an inherent subsidy, and I think that the bank should have to pay for that subsidy in the form of higher taxation.
Well, David McDonald, I want to thank you for elaborating on this report that you submitted months ago. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And David McDonald is senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. He heads the Centre's Alternative Federal Budget.
That was Money by Pink Floyd. And you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast on CKUW 95.9 FM and broadcast on our partner stations across Canada. Our shows are podcast at the Center for Research on Globalization website at globalresearch.ca. You can leave feedback on our show at globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. On Wednesday, December 5th, a challenge by two Canadians and the group Comer, the Committee for Monetary and Economic Reform, was addressed in federal court by the Government of Canada. Observer Connie Fogle wrote the following memo about the trial. Memo. Regarding the Bank of Canada court application December 5, 2012 by government to strike out our challenge regarding the use of the Bank of Canada as intended by statute. This application by the government heard today was not dealing with the merits of our case, but rather just with whether or not we had a right to be heard at all by the court and to bring forward the challenge. However, in the process, much of the substance of the case was referenced, which made the arguments exciting to hear. The courtroom was not big enough to seat the numbers of the public who wanted in. There were as many people outside the courtroom as inside. This did impress the judge, who thanked the public for being there, taking an interest in these matters. Rocco Galati, our lawyer, was brilliant and thorough in his presentation. He seemed to answer every question by the judge with great persuasion. The public reacted to the representation with an electric excitement, a satisfaction that this case was coming across as one of international as well as national historical import. The court has reserved judgment on whether or not we have the right to proceed. His decision will likely be rendered within weeks. Has Canada handed over jurisdiction over its monetary and socioeconomic policy over to foreign interests? This question is at the heart of a lawsuit directed to the Bank of Canada and to the Canadian Minister of Finance. The legal challenge argues that the surrender of Canadian sovereignty over critical government financing powers happened decades ago when the federal government started to borrow from private banks as opposed to the nation's central bank, the Bank of Canada. The case appeared before the federal court this week. Joining us on the line to discuss it, nationally renowned Toronto-based lawyer Rocco Galati. Rocco Galati is speaking to us from his office in Toronto. So thank you for joining us, Rocco.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, so could you, before we go maybe into the nuts and bolts of the case, do you think you maybe can explain a little bit more about that role of the Bank of Canada historically and how you see things, or how your the plaintiffs in this case have see the Bank of Canada going awry?
Okay, but just before I do that, I just want to correct something slightly. What we had in federal court on December 5th was the government's motion to strike the claim, and the court reserved on that motion, and we've argued the full day on it. Basically, the action breaks down into two broad strokes. Firstly, it's challenging the government's refusal to exercise the power given to it by the Bank of Canada when it was initially set up as a public bank in 1938, and one of the primary purposes it was set up as a public bank was for the Bank of Canada to float interest-free loans to the federal, provincial, and municipal governments for what we're calling human capital expenditure, that is education, health, and whatnot, public works that were necessary. They did that, the bank did that up until 1974 when the Bank of Canada joined the Bank of International Settlements over in Basel, Switzerland. Canada's central bank is the only bank in the G20 that's actually a public bank. All other banks in Europe and in the United States are private banks. So people don't understand this. The Federal Reserve in the United States is not a public bank. The Bank of England is not a public bank, and so on. So under the Bank of Canada Act, under Section 2017, the Minister of Finance holds all the shares on behalf of Her Majesty the Queen. In other words, the Minister of Finance holds the assets of the Bank of Canada for the people of Canada. Under Section 14, if there's a disagreement between the Minister of Finance and the Governor of the Bank of Canada, the Minister has the final say. So since 1974, the Minister of Finance has refused to request these loans for human capital expenditures. That, now, the way the loans worked is they were interest-free up to a maximum of a third of the annual budget, which had to be paid in the next fiscal year, which is okay because most of those loans were paid. And what it did was it avoided the interest, which amounted to a deficit and accumulating debt. The bizarre thing about all of this is that the Bank of Canada, right now, for instance, in the last few years, is floating money to the commercial banks at, you know, anywhere from half a percent to a percent interest. And the commercial banks are lending it to the government back to us at a commercial rate that's two or three times that. And that begs the question of why? Why bother? The other thing that's happening is that the Bank of Canada progressively has taken its marching orders from these international groups, which are simply private bankers. So we have a public bank taking marching orders from a bunch of private individuals over in Europe and determining Canadian sovereignty with respect to the currency, interest, and socioeconomic development that the Bank of Canada was set up initially to oversee. The second part of this whole challenges the Minister of Finance, same minister, his refusal and inaction in providing the House of Commons the true figure of total revenues every year before the House of Commons decides whether or not to borrow to meet its budgetary needs. So, for instance, they say every year, we've got revenue of $240 billion. We need $280 billion, so we're going to borrow $40 billion. Well, that's not actually accurate. They don't give the total revenue collected or collectible before the various tax credits under the taxing statutes are remitted back to the taxpayers. That includes everything from child tax credits to research and development, all sorts of corporate tax credits that go back. So the parliamentarians don't have the actual true revenues. And why this is important is because if they did, they could effectively debate whether or not they want to run a deficit and pay all this interest to commercial banks. Mm. And that, where that ties into is that there's a constitutional right to no taxation without representation under the Canadian Constitution. And if the parliamentarians don't have all the figures, they cannot effectively debate what taxation levels are necessary and if running a deficit every year is necessary or not, because they don't know how much is still available in tax credits. They may choose to trim the tax credits if they saw fit. So basically, those are the two bases of the challenge.
Okay, now you mentioned, first of all, that the Bank of Canada is but that basically government is now borrowing from private banks at market rates of interest as opposed to low rates of interest from Bank of Canada.
Right.
But at the same time, there's this the second prong of the challenge having to do with the lack of accounting or improper accounting of the government revenue before tax credits.
Which is a constitutional requirement.
Did these happen at the same time, or was there a...
No, they don't happen at the same time, but they're interrelated.
Yeah.
They're connected because it's the same Minister of Finance who's refusing to request low interest or interest-free loans from the Bank of Canada to directly provide the levels of government mm-hmm. with human capital infrastructure expenditures. And it's the same Minister of Finance who's deciding to run deficits without telling us how much money is actually coming in.
So Now, basically, the fact that this change has happened, I did a little bit of research into this, and what they keep mentioning is this whole issue of inflation, that inflation rose from 1961 at 2% to 1974. It was a 20-year high of 12.5%.
Well, that's laughable, because when we started getting our money from the commercial banks, I came out with a student loan debt in 1987 at 23% interest. Mm. So when it was handed over from the Bank of Canada to commercial banks, it doubled from 12% to 24%. This thing of inflation is a fallacy. I'll tell you why. Why is it inflationary if the Bank of Canada gives it to government at 0% interest, but it's not inflationary if the Bank of Canada gives it to the commercial banks at that interest rate? I mean, this is ridiculous, and we deal with that in the statement of claim. This is a red herring, and it's not inflationary because the money has to be paid back in the next fiscal year. So you have a six-month window. There's no inflationary load to the Bank of Canada. Floating this money interest for your very low interest. There was no inflationary load between 1938 and 1965. The 70s, the inflation in the 70s had a lot to do with a lot of other things, including Keynesian, you know, public spending and the decision to get into debt to build universities. If you recall, that was, you know, the late 60s through the late 70s was when a lot of our universities and public institutions were built, but they had already decided in 74 of no more Bank of Canada loans for that. So a large part of that inflationary movement that happened as a result of us borrowing money from the commercial banks and not from the Bank of Canada.
Yeah, it seems to me that, like, when looking back, I mean, Pierre Trudeau, who was the prime minister under which this change happened, a lot of people accuse him of overspending, and that's why we have these monster deficits, because of, I guess, irresponsible spending.
We have evidence that the former Prime Minister Trudeau, after he agreed to join the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, didn't really understand the economic impact, and years later regretted it as a huge mistake. He didn't really understand what he was advised to do, and he regretted it.
Hmm. Yeah. So he had was it his finance minister that was recommending this?
I don't recall. Okay. I don't recall, but certainly there's evidence that he was not fully aware, because, as you know, he was a law professor. Economics was not his forte.
No. Okay, so as far as this this lawsuit that happened, or no, sorry, it is happening, and you called it a motion to strike by the government,
right,
which means
typically
precisely
the government, if it can try to get a court to just put a bar to having the thing heard or sweep it under the rug, or, you know, in the hopes that they can bamboozle the courts into thinking this is overly broad or too complex to deal with, or, you know, the parties don't have standing and there's no action. They bring out all the artillery, hoping that the court just says we don't want to hear this at all. This is too important an issue. It's solidly grounded in constitutional law, and it should not be struck. And we're awaiting the decision on reserve, and we'll take it from there. If it's not struck, or if not a significant portions are struck, then we proceed with the action. If it is, we appeal.
Now, I recall, like, this was first announced in December of last year, so I think it's about a year minus a week since this was announced. And at that time, I believe one of the people you're representing, Ann Emmett, was talking about how between 81 and 95, we spent $620 billion in taxes, and $420 billion of that went to the banks as payment on interest.
Than that. Since 1974, servicing the debt to the commercial banks has amounted to $1.4 trillion in interest alone.
Yeah, that's
okay. So just that's like the equivalent of 6 years of federal budgets.
Mm-hmm.
That's just interest.
Okay, so that doesn't sound terribly efficient. And another aspect of this is the way that money is created in our society, right?
The banks basically allowed
the banks to create money.
Right, that's a side issue. I note with interest that the IMF announced last week that they are now demanding that currencies be again backed by assets like they used to be with the gold standard in 1973. Because it's a real problem. The IMF, which is in the business of controlling less developed countries, realizes now that if everybody just prints the money, it can just, even if they devalue that currency at 10 cents on the dollar, they can just print their way out of debt.
Yeah, and again, like what we're hearing, like from economists, like across the spectrum, is that when you have the Bank of Canada the Bank of Canada prints up all this money, that you end up with more demand than supply.
Well, quite frankly, economists' opinion is irrelevant to me in the lawsuit. We can deal with that opinion at trial. What any court case is grounded on is legal and constitutional obligations. They can debate that till the cows come home. Economics is not a physical science. However, what they cannot debate is the statutory framework that is in the Bank of Canada, why it was created, and the arbitrary, nonsensical refusal to comply with the duty under the bank for which it was created, based on specious arguments that make no sense whatsoever. And so the claim is grounded in both the Minister of Finance and the Government of Canada in abdicating their duty to govern, which is a constitutional violation, first of all. And secondly, the Minister of Finance flagrantly breaching his constitutional duty under the No Taxation Without Representation to provide Parliament with a full set of both ledgers of the books before they decide to consent to impose the taxes to provide the revenue to Her Majesty, represented by the executive, for that session of Parliament. People have to remember that as far back as the Magna Carta, only Parliament can impose taxes. But in order to impose taxes, the Supreme Court of Canada has said that they have to have an informed debate. You can't have an informed debate in Parliament if you don't know how much actual revenue you're collecting.
No. You basically need to have access to the facts.
That's right, and the public has that right too, because they have a right under the constitutional right of citizens to no taxation without representation, to approach their elected officials, and try to convince them that it should be this way or this way. We're not saying that we want a result of our own in Parliament. We're just saying that you can't do it this way. If the Parliament has a blind spot, then the constitutional rights with respect to taxation and expenditure and budgetary process have been breached.
Mm-hmm. But this kind of transparency, you have that in the United States, right?
Of course.
And other countries, but Canada has, no. I mean, it's distinguished itself by the fact that A, it's a crown corporation, the Bank of Canada, and B, you don't have that level of transparency.
Well, calling it a crown corporation is misleading. It's not a crown corporation.
The Bank of Canada.
Yeah, it's a public bank. It's a statutory bank created by Parliament in which the Minister of Finance holds the shares, the assets of the bank, in trust for Her Majesty the Queen, or in other words, the citizens of Canada. That is not a crown corporation.
A crown corporation is supposedly at arm's length.
Right.
And this is not because
of the government.
This is
not a crown corporation. Yeah. It is the people's bank.
Okay. Well, there's not. Have you discovered that there's any media attention on this issue? It doesn't. I'm not hearing. I mean, the main headlines today have been having to do with the NHL lockout and.
Well, it's highly perplexing, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I somehow think that the absence of media coverage of this case has to do with some government pressure on the media not to cover it.
Okay.
I mean, the independent media has covered it all over the place. I mean, our initial press conference has been carried by, hundreds of thousands of websites around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I've had calls from all over the world on this.
Yeah. So the what then are the consequences should you be successful?
Well, then the trial goes ahead and the government will have to deal with these issues.
Okay. Well, you mean in terms of this
lawsuit,
today's motion. But should you be successful in, you go forward with this entire process, and at the end of the day, will we see the Bank of Canada having to
return to its
obligations under the Bank of Canada Act? And
if we're successful in declaratory relief, yeah, they will have to revisit this nonsense of giving the commercial banks free money and then the commercial banks lending it back to the government, the commercial rates. I mean, what is this?
Yeah.
This is nonsense. This is an unconstitutional use of the Bank of Canada, and it also breaches the terms for which it was set up. The other dimension is, why do we have foreign private interests dictating to the bank what the interest rate policies, the currency policies, and everything else is going to be? And it's not as if these people are brilliant. They've literally caused the collapse of the financial system in the G20 countries. The Federal Reserve, it's just come out on the audit, printed $16 trillion to save their banks. Our government has, put in over $100 billion in buoying our banks. So why are we doing this at public expense and letting the Bank of Canada wither down to nothing except interest rate policy, trying to keep inflation between 1% and 3%? That's all they do now. It's abdicating their duty under the Bank of Canada Act to govern with respect to these issues.
Now, when you talk about foreign private interests, we're talking essentially about the Bank of International Settlements and the...
Well, that is comprised of private bankers from Europe and elsewhere.
Yeah.
They're private bankers. People have to understand, they're not accountable to any government. They're private interests.
Hmm.
Bank of Canada is not private. It's our money.
Yeah.
It's our bank.
And so with this, and being under that umbrella, they're essentially... between that and the finance minister not properly disclosing the proper revenue, where they're effectively getting determining the direction in which our where we outlays of revenue or outlays of taxpayer dollars will go towards programs in the public interest.
That has an immense impact on socioeconomic programs. It has on human capital expenditure, and it's all explained in the statement of claim, and it in turn has a huge impact on the devolution of our society and the quality of life in our society at the control of foreign interests, private interests.
Yeah. Rocco, do you mind telling us how you personally got connected with this particular campaign?
This is not a campaign. There's nothing personable about me. I'm a lawyer. I got retained by my clients to bring this action.
Yeah,
I'm a constitutional lawyer, and they had these issues, and they retained me, and I pleaded their case.
Okay.
And this is not a campaign on my part.
Well, I guess it's a campaign on the part of Comer.
Yes, the Committee on Economic and Monetary Reform, but it's not my campaign.
Mm.
I think they're right in their position, and that's why I took it on. And they're statutorily and constitutionally sound arguments, but it's not a personal campaign I'm on.
No, yeah, but it does seem as if because I know you've been gotten a lot of attention from mostly from the terrorism related cases that you've done. So it does seem like you have a knack for taking on these high profile.
Well, listen, Michael, I've represented well over 9,000 people in my legal career, and I've had 7 high profile terrorism cases. We live in a bread and circus society.
Yeah.
I have a master's of law in taxation, a I'm a former justice lawyer, tax litigator. I do all sorts of constitutional work. The press likes what it likes, the mm-hmm. bread and circus.
I see.
Certainly the security certificate and terrorism cases work I did were relevant in terms of the current constitutional issues that our society is facing, and I'm proud to have done them and succeeded for a lot of my clients, by the way, because a lot of those provisions were nonsense and a lot of the cases brought were nonsense. But certainly, you don't marry the lawyer to the cause. Primarily, I care about the rule of law and constitutionalism and that the society is governed by the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be in taxation, I have a case against the Minister of Health right now, a huge constitutional challenge to the way they're dealing with natural health products, for instance. Those clients of mine have serious constitutional questions to raise. And so I've done constitutional work in the immigration context. So it all has that that same strain. That's what I do. I'm a constitutional lawyer. And so whether it be in tax, criminal, immigration, health, wherever there's government action that breaches people's constitutional rights, I'm approached and retained.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in this particular case, the stakes are very high. It could ultimately transform the whole mechanism by which we've been financing our whole system, and basically taking it back on our
right.
on our own shoulders as
well. Not
citizens.
Transform it, bring it back to the sanity it had before
yeah.
it went insane.
Okay.
I mean, we were there before. We've just gone down a path that has melted not only the stock market, the real estate market, but now the financial market,
mm-hmm.
because we have wayward, renegade private interests overriding the public gatekeeper of the sovereign governments to determine their own socioeconomic and financial agendas.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what remains, though, is just the question, like when you mentioned Trudeau realizing that he'd made a mistake. I mean, to what extent are our elected representatives aware that this is happening?
Most of them don't have a friggin' clue.
Right.
Most of them don't have the wherewithal and the expertise to chase this down. This is when it comes to constitutional matters, this is why the Supreme Court of Canada and the Quebec Secession Reference ruled very clearly that the constitutional pillar of democracy does not end with parliamentary majority rule. It ends with the rule of law and constitutionalism, and that our system has changed from a parliamentary supremacy to a constitutional supremacy. So Parliament can do what it chooses so long as it doesn't cross constitutional constraints and breach constitutional imperatives or constitutional rights of the citizen.
Hmm. Okay, well, yeah, it's a very important case that you're representing, and you have no idea when a decision is going to be rendered, is that?
No, but I suspect in the next 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
All right.
All right, well, Rocco Galati, thank you. Thank you very much for sharing those perspectives with us on the day of this important trial, and hopefully we can get some updates from you in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's the Global Research News Hour for this week. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering stations across the country. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.